Assalamu alaikum everyone. Now we have arrived in Iznik, also called Nicaea. The ancient name of this city was Nicaea or Nicaea. This is where the famous Council of Nicaea took place once upon a time. This was a very important city. The Ottomans took this city in 1331. Sultan Orhan Ghazi took this city. And inshallah, we will be visiting the city. But for now, we are going to Yusuf Donor. This is one of the most famous donor places or kufta places in the country, and their meat is absolutely delicious, and we're going to show you when it's cooked and when it's in front of us. You can have a look at it as well, inshallah.
Okay, somewhere. Everyone, we are inside, and this is what the kufta looks like. Is this gone? Okay,
you can see the variety of food we have here. Okay, the salads. And the koftas, fresh meat, and there's a meat shop in the back as well. So the meat belongs to the company. They do their own meat, and it's absolutely amazing. And once the kofta is cooked, we will show you more, inshallah, what it looks like.
Okay, everyone, this is what kofta here looks like. Amazing, absolutely delicious. This place is well known for the quality of meat, for the taste, and generally, Istanbul, the food is not very nice because it's very commercialized, too many tourists around. They don't really put too much attention on quality. But when you leave Istanbul, and we are now in Iznik, which is about 2 hours drive from Istanbul, the food has gone so much better, right? There is salad, there is soup, so good quality meat. So I just wanted to share this with you. Yusuf is the place. If you ever come to Iznik, Yusuf is the place. And I'm not getting paid for this, by the way, yeah? In case you think that I'm doing advertisement. I'm not getting paid for this. This is confirmed, okay? I love this food. And this may be a reason for you to come and join one of our tours. Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Everyone, I am now standing in front of the great walls of the city of Nicaea, now called Iznik. Okay, this was an ancient city, very important for the Greeks and then the Romans. The walls you see right next to me were built by Romans, and they were strengthened or fortified further by Emperor Hadrian in about 123 CE. They are nearly 2,000 years old. Actually, 1,900 years old to be precise, when the last major improvements were made. You can see how far the wall goes. Okay. This wall runs around the city for 5 kilometers, about 4,970 meters. Okay, about 5 kilometers of wall around the city of Nicaea. So let's move that way, inshallah, with the group. Okay, so we started the tour from Nicaea because this is where the history starts. This is where the history of the Roman Empire, and before that, the Greeks were here during the period. Just after Alexander the Great, the city was established. Okay, the city was named after the wife of one of Alexander's general, later on King Lysimachus. His wife was called Nicaea, and then the city became Nicaea. Now you can see these. This is one of the major gates, one of the four major gates of the city of Nicaea. We'll go down, inshallah, and see. It's still very much intact. Look at the blocks, how big they are. Massive work gone into this. Imagine slaves, workers carrying these blocks. You can still see some of the inscriptions there, some of the artwork, carvings. They have lasted for nearly 2,000 years. Now, you remember that Roman road we just saw? Same technology here. The same technology here. This is a Roman. This is what a Roman road would look like, typically. Okay, it looks a bit uneven, but Roman roads were beaten roads. They were made of stone mainly because they had to use these roads for transportation, bull and cart, horses, things like that. There is Greek written on the gate. You can still see Greek there, very visible. Okay, I cannot read Koine Greek, right? It's written high, right here. Okay.
So there is an inscription on the middle door arch, one on the inside and one on the outside. The one on the inside reads, "These walls were built in the name of the Imperial Dynasty and Emperor Hadrian under the supervision and control of the famous Nicene Metropolitan Cassius." The one on the outside reads, "The people of the city had this structure built with the money sent to the empire in the year of," and the year is not there, unfortunately, right? So you just got the translation of the inscription that is there. In other words, Emperor Hadrian and Cassius are mentioned there. Hadrian ruled in the first half of the 2nd century CE, very powerful emperor. Okay, he ruled from Britain all the way to current day Iraq, on the borders of Iraq. Okay, Hadrian's empire stretched from Britain to Spain, to France, to parts of North Africa, even the Middle East. Okay, and all the way meeting the borders of the Persian Empire at that time. So he was one of the most powerful men in the world at the time, and he was one of the five good Roman emperors with Marcus Aurelius. So Marcus Aurelius was one of the successors of Hadrian, who came after Hadrian. And Hadrian, you can see his face very distinct on his coins, or his you can see statues made, you can find them in museums. He had very distinct features, very long neck. If you have seen Hadrian, who's seen Hadrian? The pictures, right? So he had very distinct looks, right? So very well-known emperor, and this was built during his time. Okay, obviously, because the gate mentions his name. Now, if you look at it, how it's been constructed, it still stands to this day, 2,000 years later. This is Roman construction. This is what the Romans were made for. This is what they made a name for.
Guillotine gate.
Right.
The iron gate.
Yeah. So there would be a gate in the middle. That's why you see this empty spot. The empty spot, because there was a gate standing here. So the gate would be opened and closed for people, right? If you are allowed to come in, you go in. Otherwise, you stay out. Okay. So they would come in from this side. Okay. They would come because that's where the city is. So the gate would open and close from this side. Okay. I don't know. So the inscriptions are there. You can see, unfortunately, over time, they have gone blurry. They are in Greek. So the name of the emperor is in Greek, because primarily this was a Greek city. You can see very clearly there.
And there should be two statues on both sides.
Yeah, so these empty spaces were, of course, there were statues there, possibly of Roman emperors or deities.
How was it defended? Like, what are the, like, where were the soldiers, and how was it defended?
There are three gates.
Yeah. So look, this is a wall. This is an outer wall. This is the inner space. Okay, buffer zone, and then that's the gate over there. So this is not easily broken. You cannot get inside unless you have some serious technology at your disposal. This is why these cities. Look at the blocks here. Look how big. Yeah, imagine how many people carried them. Imagine how many people would have carried those stones on the arch and placed them together. And it still stands to this day after 2,000 years. This is Nicaea. Okay, so if you come out very quickly, you can see pillars carved of marble. From that side, they're lying around. You can see this carving here. Yeah, and there is some carving outside here as well.
And also, it's pretty.
Yeah, that remains from that period. There are soldiers, Roman soldiers depicted. You can see there are soldiers carrying shields in their distinctive Roman clothing. You can see the pillar in the middle. Can you see the pillar in the middle, everyone? Yeah. So this represents something that we have lost, unfortunately. And the walls go quite far. If you all come this side, please. This is how you get an idea of how the city walls were built and what was used for the foundations. Look at these blocks. These are heavy blocks, very big, and the wall was resurrected on top of these blocks. And look, the foundations go back to the Greek period as well, because the first walls were built during the Greek period, and then later on Roman emperors came, Vespasian and Trajan, and then after that Emperor Hadrian, they built this magnificent structure that stands to this day. Okay, so a very imposing structure, very important for people to know. Okay, and then these were the very walls the Ottomans had to face in 1331. Sultan Orhan Gazi was standing in front of these very walls built during the Roman period. This is how strong these walls were, and this is how long they lasted. And then he had to besiege the city and took it successfully in 1331. And since then, it has been in Turkish hands or Ottoman hands. Okay, this was Greek territory, and then it became Roman territory. Then from Roman territory, it became Byzantine, who were also Romans, territory. And then the Ottomans.
So okay. The Seljuk never made it here.
No, Seljuks are ruling all this territory, but the Seljuks at that time, they had not come this far, no. Okay, this was even during the Seljuk period, this was Roman territory, Byzantine territory. Seljuks did take much of Anatolia after the Battle of Manzikert in 1071, but they had not come this far. This was later on when, remember, Emperor Michael the Eighth, you said, yeah, had taken back Constantinople, these towns fell into neglect, and this is when the Turkish nomadic tribes, they rose and they took this territory and eventually became a power. So the Kai tribe of the Ottomans was actually a nomadic entity, and later on they became expert fighters. They settled down in towns and they built cities and towns, and over time they became expert architects, and they created a civilization of their own, as you can see. Okay, having of course taken knowledge from other civilizations, other models they followed. Okay, when you look at the architecture in Bursa, it's very different to what you see in Constantinople, because once the Ottomans took Constantinople, they saw Hagia Sophia, which was a magnificent structure. They found new ideas, new skills, new techniques to build, and then they resurrected some monumental, gigantic mosques, as you can see, Suleymaniye, Fatih Mosque, and all the other great masterpieces built by architect Sinan, who was working for Sultan Suleyman the Magnificent. We'll talk more about him when we are in Istanbul, inshallah. On that note, thank you so much. Let's walk back, inshallah.
Okay, everyone. This is the tomb of the famous vizier of Sultan Muhammad al-Fatih. His name was Shandarli Khalil Pasha. He's even given a very important role in a series produced by Netflix. Season one, you see Shandarli Khalil Pasha, his role in trying to help the Sultan take the city. But Sultan somehow came to believe that he was collaborating with the Romans, and he was undermining his authority. You see, when Sultan Muhammad al-Fatih was put on the throne for the first time, when he was a very young man, okay, and he tried to rule, but Shandarli Khalil Pasha, he believed that Sultan Muhammad al-Fatih is not ready. He undermined him and asked for his father to come back to take power again, Sultan Murad II. And Sultan Muhammad al-Fatih never forgot that undermining. He kept it inside him.
Personal.
He made it personal. It became a personal thing. But Shandarli Khalil Pasha was doing the right thing, in my opinion. You know, he wanted the dynasty to survive, the state to function properly, and because Murad II, rahmatullah alayh, was an able ruler, a very strong ruler, he wanted him to come back to deal with the crusader threat, because the crusaders were coming and they were attacking the Muslim territories. So Sultan Murad came back and dealt with the crusaders. Okay, and then Sultan Mahmud al-Fatih was put on the throne again the second time. Now his mission was to take the city of Constantinople, and he does that in 1453. Okay, and one of the first things he does after taking the city, he kills Shandarli Halil Pasha. Now whether the accusations against him were true or not is a very good question. Scholars have wrestled with these questions for a very long time, but I believe Sultan Mahmud al-Fatih was not a fool. He was not someone who would just act and do self-harm by killing an able wazir. So he must have strong reasons. He must have strong reasons to do what he did, right? You can't just remove or kill, because sultans are generally usually very pragmatic. They look at pros and cons. They will ignore your weaknesses and focus on your strengths and use you for the strengths. So he must have had strong reasons to believe what he believed. Just like that, another mystery is Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent killing his own son Mustafa. It's a mystery. After killing him, Sultan Suleiman sat next to his dead body for 3 days without eating and sleeping. 3 days, right? Mourning. But he had strong reasons. People accused Roxolana, Horem Sultan, for creating a conspiracy against Mustafa to get him killed so that her son can become the Sultan. But I believe Suleiman was not a fool. Rahmatullah alayh. He had reasons. He killed his own son, but he must have reasons to believe that his son was causing intrigues.
But that's what they did. They killed the brothers, grandfathers, and each son.
Yeah, this is a very good question.
Every
why did the
question is the death of somebody.
Yeah.
Either father or son.
When a sultan would come to power, later on, Ottomans, and this was started by Sultan Muhammad al-Fatih, by the way, that what we call fratricide. Okay? Killing of your siblings.
That's what Mughals did too.
No. Mughal system was different. Mughals did it differently. They did it, but they did it differently. Here in this case, once the Sultan comes to power, he rounds up close relatives and they are strangled to death. Right? Why did they do this? Because they wanted to rule with peace. And the threat was from these princes to launch rebellions, and the Byzantines, the Romans, were always happy to support such rebels and rebellions. So any prince who would rise in rebellion could easily find support with the Romans. So the sultans, they decided that to do away with this problem, we just kill the royal princes and princesses.
The fratricide was established.
They had two choices. They kill 10, 20, 30 people, or they kill 100,000 or 200,000. Because when there's a rebellion, what happens in a rebellion? Cities rebel, these princes go and take cities, then the sultan has to besiege the city to crush the rebellion, to go and do more important things like fighting the Romans, right? So these princes would rise in rebellion and they would fight the sultans, and as a result, hundreds of thousands of people would be killed. One of the examples is after Timur defeated Sultan Bayezid Yıldırım in the Battle of Ankara, five sons of Sultan Bayezid were fighting each other for nearly 20 years. And the Ottoman Empire was devastated, completely wrecked. It almost crumbled. I'm not justifying fratricide, by the way, yeah? In case you think I'm saying this is the logic, this is the rationale they used to do what they did. These are very brutal times. You have to be very brutal in execution of the law and to maintain law and order. So they had to make very difficult decisions. Of course, you cannot justify that Islamically. Islamically speaking, you cannot justify. There were other solutions. If you're scared of princes, put them under house arrest. But they tried all that. They tried all that. One prince escaped, that's it. Game over. Now you have a big problem at hand. You have to fight a rebellion. coming back to Shandarli Ali Pasha, the tomb is on the road of Lefke Gate, the famous Shandarli Halil Pasha, who is the eldest son of Shandarli Ibrahim Pasha and the Grand Vizier of the previous of Murad II and Fatih Sultan Muhammad, was executed. Shandarli Halil Pasha was executed after the conquest of Istanbul and buried next to his sons who died before him. Shandarli Halil Pasha served as a Grand Vizier of the Ottoman Empire for 14 years, between 1439 and 1453, and was the first Grand Vizier to be executed in the Ottoman Empire. Due to his cautious attitude during the siege of Istanbul and his alleged secret cooperation with the Eastern Roman Empire, he was arrested and jailed after the conquest of Istanbul, and then he was executed. So just because he was very cautious, he wasn't in favor of an aggressive policy, he was trying to persuade or dissuade the Sultan to pursue a very extremely aggressive policy, he was suspected of collaborating with the Romans. And here he lies in front of us in a very humble tomb, the most powerful man in the Ottoman Empire after the Sultan himself, Shandarli Halil Pasha. Okay.
Bismillah. We are here in front of Hagia Sophia. Now, this is not the Hagia Sophia of Constantinople or Istanbul. This is the Hagia Sophia of Iznik. This was the central church in Iznik, built by the Romans, okay? And of course, Romans continued to add to it. It was renewed in the 11th century. And then later on in 1331, when Sultan Orhan Ghazi took the city of Nicaea, now Iznik, from the Romans, this was naturally turned into the masjid because the city was taken by force. And according to the rules and the conventions of the time, when you take a city by force, everything within the city belongs to you. So the Sultan owns it. So he took the building and turned it into a mosque. And since then, it's been a masjid. It is claimed that there was a church on this site originally that may have been the site, of the famous Council of Nicaea. This is one of the candidates. Okay, so this could be one of the sites where the Council of Nicaea took place. There is another site that we will look at tomorrow before we leave the city of Iznik, which is now underwater. And it was only recently when they discovered that site, due to an aerial view, they could see in the water that there was a building in the shape of a basilica, right? And then they realized that this was actually a church that is now underwater, and it's very close to the ancient palace of Emperor Constantine. And the sources tell us that Constantine convened this council, this ecumenical council, the church council in this city, very close to his palace. Now, close to his palace can mean that basilica right next to his palace underwater now, or it could be this, because this is also very close. It's literally 5 minutes walk from the palace of Constantine. So these are the two candidate sites that basically are thought to be the sites where the Council of Nicaea took place. The Council of Nicaea, they discussed the nature of Christ. Christians, they were brought together by Emperor Constantine, because now he is the emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire, and he is interested in peace. He wants harmony in his empire, and Christians are fighting each other over the nature of Christ. One group of Christians, the majority, believed that Jesus was a creation of God. He was not God like God the Father. If he was God, he was God in some lower capacity. He was a subordinate creator, a creation of God. But other group of Christians, they were insisting, no, Jesus Christ is as God the Father. So he's on par with God the Father. God basically consists of, by this time, at least two people or two personalities, two persons. The third personality is still not discussed at the Council of Nicaea in 325 CE. The third personality will be discussed 50 years later at the Council of Constantinople, where the doctrine of the Trinity was finally formalized in 381 CE in the Council of Constantinople during the reign of Emperor Theodosius. We will see the site of that council as well, which is in the Church of Saint Irene, right? the Church of Saint Irene. It is now part of the Topkapi Palace complex. We will see that church where that council took place. So here the issue of Jesus Christ was discussed. Who is he? God, or a creation of God, or some kind of lower god, a demigod, right? And Emperor Constantine, he intervened and he forced all the bishops to sign the doctrine that Jesus Christ was of the same essence as God the Father. So he was the very God from very God. Basically, he was God with capital G. And whether that site was this or the one underwater, we will see tomorrow, it is not clear. But one lesson is clear. Where this kufr was actually formalized, this shirk, this blasphemy against Allah was actually formalized, one site potentially is a masjid, the other side is underwater. Where the Christian religion as we know it today was born, and this is why it is in sharp decline. Christianity is losing numbers rapidly. It is the most declining religion in the world today, right? Because people are losing faith in Christianity. They are either becoming atheists or something else. They are going into Islam or Buddhism and other faiths because they find Christianity to be very unsatisfying, right? And the reason is these kind of absurdities that were formalized here, that Jesus Christ, a human being, was God, on par with God the Father, God the Creator, okay? So one candidate side is a masjid now, the other candidate side is underwater. So you can only imagine what happened to the creed, okay? The Creed of Nicaea was formalized here, yes.
Who started that idea that Jesus could be God?
Who started that idea? It started with the Hellenic Greek believers in Jesus Christ. Basically, this was not the Jewish people who came up with this idea. This were the Romans. Romans already believed in many gods, right? For them to add another god, another man god, wasn't a big deal. They believed in Apollo, Jupiter, Minerva, Heracles, these Zeus. They had these stories, right?
They were the Greeks.
Sorry? The Greeks and the Romans. The Romans also followed some of these deities. They adopted these deities from the Greeks, right? So the Romans, for them, this was not a big deal. Okay, another god, another god-like figure, god-man, walking on earth. So they are the ones who came up with this idea, and this is a huge topic, okay, when Jesus became God and how he became God. Books have been written on this very topic, okay? There is a book by, if I'm not mistaken, his name is, the author is called Rubinstein. He's a Jewish author, and he writes about how Jesus became God, okay? How he turned into God suddenly, right? There are other authors who have written, like Giza Vermis, okay, Changing Faces of Jesus, right? That's another book where he discusses the gospel narrative, the gospels, the four gospels, how there was a transition from one version of Jesus to another by the time we reached the Gospel of John. So this is a vast topic that we cannot discuss in this vlog, but remember, this is one of the sites, and we will go inside now, inshallah. Have a look, keep coming, Hamza, keep recording, inshallah. You can tell by these inscriptions, they're from the Roman period, they still survive. The building is very much Byzantine Roman infrastructure. Which one?
Because that was the, you know,
the temple. The temple, yeah. So there was a Roman temple at this site, and then a church was built, and now a masjid. Bismillah. This is the original floor, potentially. Okay. Now you can see that this is in the shape of a basilica. Qibla is that way. When Sultan Orhan Ghazi took the church and turned it into a masjid, the mihrab was built there in that corner over there. Unfortunately, there was a fire in the 16th century, and that fire burnt a lot of the early Ottoman design or Ottoman artwork that was done. And you can see the signs of burning on the walls. They're all black. The roof is there. It was in the 16th century when the fire burned. There are some remains from the Christian period. There are depictions of Jesus, imagined depictions of Jesus and Mary. Yeah. Do you have a light?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're going to do this.
So if...
So they are very faded, but you can see the face there. Can you see the face? Can you see the face, everyone? That is supposed to be a depiction of Jesus. This is from the Christian period. Okay? So this remains as part of the church from the Roman period. And again, when we go back here, where the altar was, inshallah. You can see the signs of burning. No, this is where the altar was. This is very Christian in design, you can see. The design is pretty thin. The mihrab isn't there, the qibla is that way. Okay? And if you come here, we have some... There's a sarcophagus here as well. Someone was buried here. Now it's empty. And when you look up there, there are still depictions and some paintings from the Christian period that survive in this building. This building was taken by Sultan Orhan Ghazi in 1331 after the city of Iznik, or the city of Nicaea, fell to the Ottomans, and it was in Roman hands. So everyone, I want to tell you, we are doing this tour so that we can educate the Muslims about the history of Muslim dynasties, including the Ottomans. We do visits of Al-Andalus, Islamic Spain, and Morocco. We are starting, inshallah, in the future we will launch more tours of other Islamic sites. We welcome you all to join these tours and these trips so that you can educate yourselves. You can check out the future dates and destinations on halalgetaways.com. Have a look, inshallah, and join in one of these destinations, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.